Hi, folks. Cliff Goldstein here. In 2004, filmmaker Spike Lee and Kevin Willmott made a spoof documentary, a mockumentary, they call it, and it was titled The Confederate States of America. And in it, these two filmmakers speculated about what would have happened had the Confederacy won the Civil War. You know, the movie starts out with the British and the French joining forces with the South, which pretty much guaranteed they were going to win the war. You know, in the film, Lincoln tries to flee and is captured in Canada and brought back. And after the movie goes on, after victory, the president of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis, makes the country one single nation, reinstitutes slavery in the northern states by offering a tax break to the people who would own slaves. And liberals and others don't fit in, that just have to flee the country and leave. And the movie goes through up to the time of the World War II, and in World War II, Americans don't get in the war with the Nazis. Instead, they end up fighting the Japanese, and at that famous picture of Iwo Jima when the Americans are holding up the flag, well, you can guess it, they're holding up a Confederate flag. And anyway, it's kind of pretty silly. I admit it, it's silly, and I think Spike Lee would probably say it was meant to be silly. After all, it was supposed to be a spoof. Now, this isn't the only time, though, that people have created what has been termed alternative histories, various speculations about what might have happened to the future if such and such an event had happened in the past. Let me give you some examples. You know, what might have happened, for instance, had a young art student named Adolf Hitler been accepted to art school instead of being rejected? How different would our world be today? How different would our lives be today? Okay. Or what would have happened, for instance, had Kennedy, heeding the advice of John Kennedy, heeding the advice of his security guard, didn't ride in the convertible that day in Dallas? Where would we, you and I, be today? How different would our lives be if that happened instead of what really happened? Or what would have happened, you know, the story of Archduke Ferdinand in World War I? What would have happened has, you know, if you know the story, they tried to kill the Archduke, they threw a bomb at his car, he missed, and so the car just, the driver drove away, and he ended up getting lost, and one of the conspirators was just happened to walk down an alley fleeing, and there's the Archduke, and he pulls out his gun and shoots the Archduke, and that causes World War I, which caused World War II, which ultimately led to the Cold War and the world we are in today. What would have happened? What would have happened if the Archduke's driver, instead of making a right turn, made a left turn and didn't drive past the assassin? How different would our world be today? Now, this isn't new. Centuries ago, a couple thousand years ago, the Roman historian Livy wrote about what would have happened had Alexander the Great expanded his empire westward instead of eastward, attacking Rome in the 4th century and maybe ending Rome even before it became the great world power that it became. You know, the first length novel in English was called Aristopia, and it was written in 1895, and it was an alternative history about what would have happened had the settlers in Virginia, they landed and they find this reef, the first settlers, a reef made of gold, and they all become rich and they establish a utopia on the shores of America. How different would our world be today? There's another book called Delenda Est, Latin, in which causes aliens cause Carthage to win the Second Punic War with Rome and eventually destroy Rome. Now, if the Punic Wars were wars that Rome had with Carthage, and as a result of beating Carthage, Rome became the great world empire that it was. And so the question is, what would have happened had Rome lost those wars and not become the great world empire? How different would history and our lives be today? Another book, it's called The Two Georges, postulates what would have happened if the United Kingdom had retained the American colonies, and with George Washington and King George making a peace treaty before they went to war. Try and imagine how different that would be. And I think it'd be a lot different than us in America just driving on the the left side of the road instead of the right side. Or which side do we? No, we drive on the right side. Yeah, in England they drive on the other side. Things would be a lot more different than that. And again, there's more. In 1962, Philip Dick published a book called The Man in the High Castle, an alternative history in which Germany and Japan won World War II. Talk about a different world. I'll tell you one thing, if the Germans would have won, I wouldn't have been here preaching this sermon right now. In 2004, American novelist Philip Roth wrote a book called The Plot Against America, which where Franklin Roosevelt is defeated in his bid for a third term and Charles Lindbergh is elected, leading to a rise in anti-Semitism and fascism in the United States. I guess you could go on and on and on with what are termed these alternative histories. And it's all speculation because in the end, nobody really knows. History in and of itself has a very strange way of taking twists and turns. Now, this could be fun. Alternative histories could be fun, but there's also a philosophical term for this, and it's called counterfactuals. And they're involved in a very narrow branch of philosophy. It's a branch of epistemology, which is what do you say when you know, what do you mean when you know something. But it's a narrow branch that's dealing with theories of causation. Now, what does that mean? Well, what do we mean when we say something causes something? You know, on first glance, that seems pretty simpler. But trust me, once philosophers get a hold of something and start looking at it carefully, they could take anything that seems so simple, and before long, it's not so simple at all. When we say something causes something else, it can mean a whole lot of different things. And it's not always easy to pin down. I think one of the best examples of this was a number of years ago, some reporter had asked the bank robber, Willie Sutton, was a big bank robber in the 30s or 40s or 20s or whatever in America. And they asked him, you know, they wanted to find out what was the cause of him robbing banks. You know, what caused him to rob banks? And so they said, why do you rob banks, Mr. Sutton? And he says, because that's where the money is. So you see, to say something causes something is not as easy and as simple as you might think. In fact, a few centuries ago, a philosopher named David Hume, whom I've talked about on this show before, he said you can never really know the cause of anything at all. He took the famous example of somebody taking a cue ball and hitting a billiard ball. And he's trying to argue that we don't know absolutely for sure that the one ball hitting the other ball is causing the other ball to move. All we have is the constant conjunction. We're used to seeing one ball hit another ball, therefore we believe that's the cause of it, but there's real no absolute reason for believing that the one hitting the other is the cause of it moving. Now, you know, there's some truth to it. I've never been overly impressed by Hume's arguments on just about anything, much less that. But there's some truth to that, and it's enough to muddy the waters a little bit. But anyway, in this question of what causes something else, these theories of causations, they've come up with these things that are called counterfactuals, which is really kind of a fancy philosophical term for what we would call an alternate history. Now, what do we mean by a counterfactual? Basically, now listen carefully, basically it says that event A could be justifiably deemed as the cause of event B if one could say that if event A didn't happen, then event B would not have happened. Can you see the point? Event A can justifiably be said to be the cause of event B if one could say that if event A didn't happen, then event B wouldn't have happened. In other words, the cause of that sound is my hand hitting the table. I heard. And if I didn't hit the table, you wouldn't have heard the sound. And therefore, that you could justifiably argue that the cause of the sound was my hand hitting the table. Now, if all that sounds pretty straightforward and commonsensical, it does. And yet, it's not really that. It's another form of the if-then. And this, if not this, then that. And if not that, then this. And that's basically the idea of the counterfactual argument. And again, on the surface, it sounds nice and easy, but it's not quite as simple as that. Let's go back to that previous thing that we looked at, okay, of Adolf Hitler being rejected from art school. If you know the story, Hitler was a failed artist and a failure. Eventually, he got into politics and, well, you know, the rest is history. But suppose Hitler had been accepted into art school. Suppose instead of being rejected, he was accepted and became a successful artist instead of a politician, instead of a head of the Nazi party. You know, then thus could one say that Hitler's rejection to art school was the cause of World War II? You know, I'm not quite sure anybody's ready to say that. But anyway, that's basically the counterfactual argument. It's an attempt at alternative histories. Now, the reason I'm getting into all this is because you have a counterfactual in the Bible. You've got it in the book of Galatians. And it's very important because I think it teaches us a very important truth about salvation. And that's what I want to look at. Now, before we begin, if there's one thing I've ever learned about reading the Apostle Paul or anything in the Bible, it's context. You need to know context, context, context. And if there's anyone who ever needed to know context with it was Paul. And I think it's particularly important in the book of Galatians. Now, Paul starts out with a very pretty uncompromising position when it comes to the first chapter in the book of Galatians. Listen to what this man writes. Galatians 1, 6 through 8. I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the gospel of Christ. But then listen to what he says. He says, but if even we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preached them to, let him be eternally condemned. Lest someone miss the point, Paul says again, as we have said so, and now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel other than what you have accepted, let him be eternally condemned. Well, you know, somebody ought to explain to Paul a little bit about pluralism. Somebody ought to explain to Paul a little bit, well, you know, Paul, don't be so close-minded. And, of course, I'm being silly. The point is Paul was being very forceful about the gospel that he preached. And if you read the book of Galatians, you realize that Paul was dealing with the fact that there were some believers who were moving away from the gospel that he preached. You were getting into some kind of works kick, getting into something, believing that they're saved by keeping the law. And this was a problem that Paul was dealing with. Now, I want to read you now what I think gets to one of the most powerful verses in all of Paul's writings, in all the Bible, on salvation by faith alone, apart from the works of the law. I want to read you his argument here because I think it's one of the most powerful things I've ever seen, showing how salvation is by faith alone and not by works of the law. So come with me now to Galatians 3:21. Again, remember the context here is Paul is writing to the group of people who are somehow backsliding from the gospel, and they're getting into some kind of legalism, and they're getting to this idea that somehow their obedience to the law can save them. Okay, he's not telling them don't keep the law, but he's warning them about somehow making your law keeping the foundation of your salvation, as if you could keep the law good enough. But don't take my word. Let me read you what Paul says. Okay, Galatians 3:21. So he's going on trying to show people about, you know, it's not the law, it's not the law. And then listen to what he says. Is the law, therefore, opposed to the promises of God? Absolutely not. For if a law had been given that could impart life, then righteousness would certainly have come by the law. Now listen to what he's saying. It's one of these if-then things. For if a law could have been given that could impart life, then righteousness would certainly have come by the law. If there had been a law that could have done this, then righteousness would have come another way. Now, Think about this for a moment. Think about this text, Galatians 3:21. Think about what he's saying here. You know, if there's a law that could bring, he's saying that if the law could have given life, then we could have had life through the law. Now, what he's talking about God's law here. Now, if anyone could make a law, wouldn't you think if anyone could make a law that would give life, it would be God, would it not? I mean, would it not be God? I mean, if anyone in the whole creation could make a law that could save us, it would be God. And yet Paul here is saying, you know, that even God can't create a law that can give us life. And yet, look, so even God can't do that. And then, for if a law could have been given that could impart life, the if implying that there is no such law, even if God created it. And think, too, if any law could give life, don't you think that it would be God's law? Okay, if anyone could give a law that could create life, it would be God. And if there was a law that you think that could impart life, it would be God's law. And yet Paul's point here, if the law could have been given that could impart life, then righteousness certainly would have come by the law. So you see what's going on here? It's coming on here that Paul is presenting an impossible hypothetical, a law that could give life. It's almost as if he were postulating the following, that there could be a circle that really was square, or there could be a positive integer that was less than zero, though it's not quite the same thing. He's stating what he believes it's impossible, even for God, and that is a law which could give life. So if the law could have been given that could give life, then righteousness and holiness and salvation could have come through the law instead of what Jesus dying for our sins. The fact that God didn't create such a law shows, one could argue, that he couldn't. Because if God could have created a law that could have given life, don't you think that would have been a better alternative than having Jesus die on the cross? But the point here with this alternative history, this counterfactual, a law that could impart life, then righteousness could come by that law. But that's not what happened, because according to Paul, that can't happen. It is impossible for a law to give life. Now, think about what this means. Does this mean we don't keep God's law? Of course not. That's not the point that Paul is saying here. He's trying to point to us the futility of doing any kind of works, of anything at all that could somehow make you holy enough to stand righteous before God. Instead, Paul's point is the only way we have the righteousness to stand before God is through the holiness and righteousness of Jesus. You know, folks, I've been a believer now, it's 1979, and if there's anything after all these years that my experience has taught me, an experience tested by the Word, if there's anything that I'm absolutely sure of after all these years, after since 1979, if there's anything that I'm sure of is that if in the end, I am going to be saved, that if I am not saved by a righteousness that exists outside of me, in place of me, a righteousness presented in my stead, no matter how much I seek to overcome, no matter how much, hey, people, Jesus has changed my life. I am nowhere near the kind of person I was. And through the grace of God, I hope in time I'll be not even the kind of person I am now. But in the end, I've learned that no matter what God has done for me, and believe me, I know it. Do I know it? My wife knows it too, but that's a whole other story. You know. But in the end, I realize that if I am not saved by a righteousness that exists outside of me, in place of me, instead of me, a righteousness covering me, then folks, at the end of that millennium, you could stare down in that wall and you can wave at me, because I'm just not going to be there. You know, there's not a doubt in my mind, I'm not going to be there. Because no matter how much I try to keep God's law, the law doesn't impart life. It can't impart life. And that was Paul's point with this. That was his whole his whole point with what he's saying with that. But, you know, and this is the truth. You know, some people say, well, but, you know, this idea of righteousness covering you, you know, that's an excuse for sin, and if you lean on that, and you know, I don't know, folks, maybe people want to use the idea of Jesus' righteousness covering us, and that my salvation is what Christ has done for me, not what he does, what I do, or even what he does in me. And if someone wants to use that as an excuse for sin, well, that's between them and God, but God is not mocked. That's not, sooner or later, that sin will overcome, and they'll make a shipwreck of everything. But see, for me, this realization, which I cling to every day of my life, folks, there isn't a day of my life that goes by where I don't have to lean on the righteousness of Jesus for me, the righteousness that he worked out in his life. If I didn't have, that's the only thing that keeps me. It's not an excuse for me to sin. It's the only thing that keeps me from giving up the faith after I do sin. Can you see the point? Can you see the point? If I didn't have this hope that I can rest on the righteousness of Jesus and what he did for me, I would have thrown this stuff out a long, long time ago. Again, that God is changing my life, there's not a doubt about it. That I'm not the kind of person I was 10, 15, 20, 30, or even before I became a believer, not a doubt about it. But in the end, I don't care how much God does in me. God does in me. If he had a million years to work on me, I'm not going to have what the Bible calls the righteousness of God, the righteousness that Jesus offers, the righteousness that comes to us by faith. And that's what I believe Paul's point was here in Galatians, in this verse. He was trying to say, hey, it's by faith in what Jesus has done for you. It's not by the works of the law. If it could have been, think about this point too. If God could have created a law that if we obeyed it well enough, we could have righteousness that way, then wouldn't that have been so much a better alternative for salvation than having to have his son and part of the eternal Godhead come down, take human form, risk losing everything, risk his own destruction, risk losing everything in order to save us? Wouldn't that have been a better way? If there could have been any other way, if God could have made a law, if God's law could have been something that could have saved us, wouldn't that have been such a better way than having Jesus come? But again, Paul's point here again, let me read you this verse in Galatians, Galatians 3:21. It's an alternative history. It's a counterfactual. And if then, is therefore the law opposed to the promises of God? Absolutely not. Now, for if a law had been given that could impart life, then righteousness would certainly have come by the law. Dwell on that. If a law, couldn't God's law do it? Couldn't God do it? According to Paul, he can't do it. Because that's not the purpose of the law. It was never made for that. Instead, that's why we have salvation as a gift. That's why we comes to us by faith, by claiming the righteousness of Jesus in, you know, for us, in place of us. You know, if you think about it for a minute, where do we get eternal life from? Eternal life comes from Jesus. And how does that come? Well, it comes by faith. Now think about this. We've got the perfect life of Jesus, which he wrought out in his life 2,000 years ago, and which he offers to us by faith. Now what does that mean? What does that mean? Okay? Because remember, the righteousness of Jesus is the righteousness of God himself. Paul says that in Romans 3:22. Jesus has the righteousness of God himself. Do you have the righteousness of God? How good is your law keeping? I don't care how good you keep the law. I don't care how obedient you are, how faithful you are, how much sanctification that God works in you. You're going to have the righteousness of God yourself flowing out of you? But Jesus, Jesus had that perfect righteousness. And the amazing thing about the gospel, is when you accept him by faith, I don't care what your past has been, I don't care how bad you've done, I don't care what your past has been, here's where we get to really good news. Here's where we get to another kind of alternative history. Because what the gospel says, is that Jesus' perfect life, his perfect life, that becomes your perfect life. Jesus' perfect record of law keeping, of obeying the law, that becomes your perfect record of obeying the law. Jesus' perfect record of obedience, the obedience and perfection that he worked out in his life, that becomes credited to you. And when God looks down, he sees Jesus' perfect obedience to the law. He says, this all is given to us in place of our imperfections, our sins, our faults. The essence of the gospel is when we surrender to Jesus, when we surrender to him, Jesus' victories, Jesus' perfect record, Jesus' righteousness, Jesus' past and his past performance and everything that he accomplished when he was here in the flesh. In other words, Jesus' history, all that, that becomes ours. And we stand before God clothed in the perfect record, the perfect righteousness, the perfect holiness of Jesus, that what he wrought out in his life. Talk about an alternative history. Talk about the only alternative history that really matters.